Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. I hope you all are doing really, really good today. And I hope I sound clear. I hope the technology from my end is working well. If you didn't have a chance to listen to my show last week, which would be April 6th, this is April 13th, 2016. I need to say that, by the way, because this show has gone on for years and maybe years more. If you didn't hear my show last week, it's one of the most important I've done because I took the hour just for myself, which I only rarely do, and talked about my overview of psychopharmacology, of the basic principles that I've evolved for understanding psychopharmacology, such as the brain-disabling principle of psychiatric drugs and indeed all psychoactive substances, medication madness, which is how drugs can drive us to do things we never under ordinary circumstances would, whether it's cocaine, sometimes even marijuana, folks, that's really true, sometimes even marijuana, amphetamines, and also many, if not most, of the psychiatric drugs, and also the principle of medication spellbinding, which describes how and why people keep taking drugs when they have having no idea at all that they're losing their quality of life. You know, what goes on? That people do it again and again, whether it's lifelong psychiatric drugs or whether it's doing street drugs. Often people think the drug is the savior. It's no difference between Prozac and methamphetamine in that regard. Of course, there are people who think it saved their lives. But why is that? Where does that idea come from? It isn't a rational idea, I believe, in most cases, since all that psychoactive substances can do is disable the brain, and that psychiatric drugs are among the most disabling, toxic substances on the face of the earth. I'm just reviewing the case of an elderly lady who was given intramuscular injections of Haldol. Now, you'd be hard-pressed to find a way of poisoning a human being better than that, faster than that, on the face of the earth, short of killing the human being, which often happens, especially in the elderly. So go and check out last week's show, April 6th, on wonderful PRN-FM. And I use as my guide for the show my new scientific article called Rational Psychopharmacology. It just came out a month or so ago, and it's available on my website, Rational Psychopharmacology. My guest today is Robert Whitaker. Bob, are you there?
I am indeed. Happy to be here.
Bob is an exemplar, Robert Whitaker, of a man who is rational and who actually does research rationally on psychopharmacology. There are about five of us in the world, and Bob's right at the top. Bob is a journalist. I tease him and embarrass him by telling him that he's actually a great scientist, which is what he is, a man who examines scientific evidence, collates it, draws it together, extracts the truth from it, and comes to conclusions as a scientist. He's an empirical scientist. And in no other era would he have been thought of as anything else. Darwin did that. Einstein did that. They didn't do a lot of experimenting to come to their most important conclusions. People of science are people who look at empirical facts and come up with new understandings and new appreciations from them. And that, obviously and most certainly, is Robert Whitaker. However, he won't ever get any scientific awards because there aren't any scientific awards given out for the kind of work Bob and I do. What you get is scientific booze. But Bob has gotten awards as a journalist, even for, and I say even for because his book is so true, even for Anatomy of an Epidemic, his 2010 book, which was won the 2010 Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for the best investigative journalism. But if you ask the American Psychiatric Association, they'd probably want to pin the tail on the donkey on him and throw darts or whatever you do there. Bob is another very huge accomplishment, of which I'm slightly jealous, only a teeny bit competitive, which is he's got a marvelous website called Madden America. I wish I had the energy to do that. Every time I talk to Bob, one of the first things he says, well, I'm a little tired. This Madden America is a lot of work. It's a lot of work, folks. It's a great website giving expression to untold numbers of people with varying viewpoints on psychiatry, usually with a critical look to them, not nearly as critical as I'd want to be, but he does put together an amazing website that gets an enormous amount of traffic. Madden America. You can't go wrong. I'm regularly taking a peek at Madden America. Once in a while, you might see something there from me, and you can look up what I've written there. Bob's new book is Psychiatry Under the Influence. And the subtitle is Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. And this is what we're going to talk about, not because Bob wanted to come here on and do a book show, but because I want Bob to talk about his new book. He was not particularly coming on to what they say, flog his book. And the book is Psychiatry Under the Influence, Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. It's written with psychologists. Is it Lisa, isn't it, Cosgrove?
Yep, that's right.
And, Bob, I'm just going to hand the mic over to you. I'm tired today. I had a very busy day. I'd love to just hear you talk about what you've been learning from this new book.
All right, I'll talk for a bit. First of all, that's a very nice invitation and nice introduction, Peter. I really appreciate it. We're just all following in your footsteps here.
You pioneered this path,
that's for sure. With, going back, I think, when was your first book? When you took on electroshock, 1980.
That was 1979.
Well, that really
pioneered. And it is still the best thing written about shock treatment. None of it has changed.
Yeah, that's what's tragic, of course.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
But anyway, it's a real pleasure and an honor to be here, Peter. So thanks for having me.
Well, I want to have you on fairly regularly. I'm moving toward having my special guests come on more often, so I may pester you a little bit.
You can pester me anytime. It really is a pleasure. Well, I'll just speak. I'll talk about psychiatry and influence and how it came about, and hopefully maybe how it advances this whole critique of psychiatry and how it's reshaped our society, because it has absolutely reshaped our society. So after I wrote Anatomy, I got invited by Lisa Cosgrove, who was a fellow at this laboratory set up at Harvard University through the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics to study institutional corruption in our society. It was set up by Larry Lessig, who had been a Stanford law dean. He actually was running for president this past time. And his idea was you have institutions with a public mission, and then they're getting corrupted by, he called them economies of influence, but basically financial factors that cause an institution to betray its public duty and public mission. And his particular interest was with Congress and the idea that the fact that people running for Congress have to raise so much money, which means they have to go to lobbyists, which means instead of serving the people, they end up serving those who fund their campaigns, the lobbyists. So Lisa Cosgrove, who has done a lot of, she's a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and she had done some work looking at how people on the DSM-4 and DSM-5, the psychiatrists there, had close ties to pharmaceutical companies, and how, of course, as they build those new diagnostic manuals with such influences present, they're obviously tempted to widen the boundaries and make it easier to get a diagnosis. It was really through her I got invited to join her, and that we would look at psychiatry through this lens of institutional corruption. And for me, it really did provide a way of thinking anew about exactly sort of the harm that has been done and how psychiatry ended up where it has ended up. And here's the framework of institutional corruption. First, you just identify the public mission, and of course, any medical specialty is supposed to put the interests of its patients first. It's supposed to serve public health. Then, two, you look at economy as an influence that may develop that will corrupt the behavior of that institution. And I'll go through this with psychiatry, and it's pretty easy to identify the economies of influence that did develop in sort of two stages. Third, next, then you try to identify the corrupt behavior. And then fourth, you look at the social injury that results from this. This sounds academic, but by the time you're done, you get a picture of psychiatry having completely reshaped our society in the past 35 years and in ways that I think have done tremendous harm. Now, one of the things about this framework is it looks to say, why does the barrel become bad as opposed to why do individuals end up as bad apples? So it's a bad barrel problem. So you're really focusing on how the whole institution becomes corrupt. And then once you go through this, the question is, what can we as a people, as a citizenry, do to fight that corruption and, you know, hopefully remove it from our societal influence and, you know, reshaping it and replace it in some ways? So we looked at psychiatry since 1980, and that was the year that, as you well know, Peter, that the American Psychiatric Association published the third edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And although, of course, psychiatry had already embraced psychopharmacology, but with this new manual, it embraced what it called a medical model, but really it was a disease model. And it was a conception of behaviors, emotional difficulties, mental difficulties in which you would say they were diseases like diabetes or cardiovascular problems. And that conception of mental disorders has really held sway in our society ever since, and increasingly so as psychiatry has promoted that idea. And it, of course, led to a dramatic explosion in the use of psychiatric drugs. So what we wanted to look at was the economies of influence that arose with the publication of DSM-3, and also what were the economies of, you know, what were the influences that led up to the publication of that book. And then so identify those economies of influence and the social and the corruption that resulted. So I think the first thing is really important to understand, and, you know, Peter, in some ways it's a little humbling to even be talking about this on your show, because you laid out so much of this whole story in your many books before, so I really mean this. We're following in your tracks and your footsteps as we maybe expand this critique in some way. But if you go back to the 1970s, psychiatry as an institution, as an association, as a medical specialty felt that it's, and you can see this in its own writings, that it was threatened with extinction. It was fighting for its survival. That was their self-perception. And why was that so? Well, you can see that there were a number of challenges to psychiatry's legitimacy that had risen up, arose in the 1960s and 1970s. The first was an anti-psychiatry movement that was based really in the academic environments. And that criticism was that within asylum medicine in particular, psychiatry functioned more as an agent of social control, as a police force almost, rather than a medical specialty. So that was a threat to psychiatry's sort of authority over, you know, mental hospitals, which is where psychiatry got its start and had long been located, was in the asylum. But then, and second, as part of that sort of threat to its legitimacy, we also had people coming out of, people who had been hospitalized, and as they came out of the hospitals, they started forming psychiatric survivor groups, And just think of the word. It's not that they were helped when they went to the hospitals, but they survived that incarceration and the various treatments they were subjected to. So now you had a patient group that's saying, we need to be free of psychiatric care. Now, that was a challenge to their domain within asylum medicine. But starting in the 1940s, psychiatry had basically left the asylum thanks to Freudian ideas. And now with the Freudian couch and its talk therapy, it had begun tending to, quote, the walking wounded. This is the neurotic patients, that sort of thing, people depressed. But by the 1970s, its authority over that group of patients, and that much larger group of patients, was also being challenged. And it was being challenged for a couple reasons. One, you had psychologists that were given different types of therapy. You had social workers. So there were many people trying to tend to the walking wounded. Second of all, you had insurance companies saying, well, why should we be paying for your talk therapy and not this other talk therapy? There's no evidence that your talk therapy is any better than anybody else's. And third, insurance companies were also saying, why should we be paying for ordinary problems of living? We just want to pay for illnesses. And there was one other thing happening in the 70s I think that's really important, and that is the first really successful commercial drugs, the benzodiazepines, Librium and Valium, were also being seen as addictive, harmful over the long term. So now we had that backlash as well. So all this, and then, of course, we had movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. We had The Myth of Mental Illness written by Thomas Soss. So there was a lot of challenges to its legitimacy. And this crisis of legitimacy really was crystallized by, I think it was David Rosenhan's piece. He was a psychologist at Stanford University who sent a number of his students around to various state hospitals, and they just, as they came to the admitting room, they just complained that they were hearing a voice that said one word, thud. Now, all of them were admitted to mental hospitals. They were diagnosed with schizophrenia. They were prescribed antipsychotics. And by the end of the study, two things had happened. The staff and the psychiatrist had never recognized these students as imposters. However, the other patients had recognized them as imposters. So he publishes this piece. I forget if it's 1972, 73, something like that.
Yeah, right there.
Yeah, and he says, basically, look at psychiatry. You can't even distinguish the insane from the sane. This was a huge embarrassment, and it was right after that that the American Psychiatric Association convened a task force to remake its diagnostic manual. Now, at least in psychiatry's own mind, there was a scientific impulse behind this remaking of its diagnostic manual, too, and that is that its diagnoses under DSM-1 and DSM-2 were quite unreliable, meaning if you went to one psychiatrist, you'd get one diagnosis, go to another one, you'd get a different one. And there was this group at Washington University that proposed this. They said, you know, we really don't have information that validates one disorder different from another. So what we should do here as a beginning step is group patients by presenting symptoms, and we'll categorize them in these different groups, and then hopefully by studying them, we'll be able to validate different disorders. And they initially came up with, I think, 18 different groups, something like that. But the whole idea was, we don't know what are these discrete illnesses, but maybe if we group them into these different types, we can, with further research, start to figure out how one is different from the other. What's the course, cause, that sort of thing. Anyway, that group gets, is really approaching this from a medical model, really a disease model as well. But it was meant to be a research document. It wasn't meant to be a diagnostic document. But anyway, under the tutelage or under the leadership of Bob Spitzer, you have these two influences. You have the influence of trying to build a new manual that will be good for research purposes, but at the same time, psychiatry wants to use this new manual to rehabilitate its image. And so what does it say to itself? How can we rehabilitate our image? It says, well, they're questioning whether we're real doctors. That's the question. That's the threat to our legitimacy. So what we need to do is wrap ourselves in white coats and present ourselves, in essence, as like infectious disease doctors. And they also understood, and you can see this in the in some of the documents, that as they looked at this competition for the walking wounded, they were in competition with psychologists and social workers, they had an advantage in the marketplace in that they could prescribe drugs. The psychologists could not. So they, you could see, well, if we adopt a disease model for this domain of our authority, both in the asylum but also for the walking wounded, what does it do? It allows us to present ourselves as doctors in white coats, and also it's sure to elevate the prescribing of drugs to a first-line therapy, because that's what you do with diseases. You prescribe, you know, some sort of medical intervention of that sort. And as they did their new manual, they had this sense too. We need to have a diagnosis for anybody who comes to us. So I think DSM-3 ends up with something like 290 categories. Is that right, Peter? You've done this. It's someone like 265. I don't know what it is, but it's over 200 categories of diagnoses. And if you actually read DSM-3, they do say these are just hypotheses. But what we've had, you can start to see the problem here. The scientific impulse was to group people into 18 or 20 groups for research purposes, and suddenly we have a new manual that is categorizing all these problems as diseases. And now what is the APA going to do and the institutional psychiatry going to do? They're going to have to now sell this new model to us. Okay, so that's the moment we're going to look at. And you can see right away there's this tension between a scientific impulse that can be seen as humble and a commercial impulse and a guild impulse to rehabilitate psychiatry. And what you're going to see as we go forward is that the guild impulse now corrupts their behavior. Okay, so we're at 1980. What economies of influence arise? Well, one, the pharmaceutical companies, of course, are delighted with this new disease model because it means all these people suffering from ordinary problems, depression, anxiety, episodes of difficulty, kids that are moving around too much in classroom to please their teachers, they're now going to be seen as having illnesses, and that opens up this large market for drugs. So immediately you start seeing the pharmaceutical companies sending a lot more money to the American Psychiatric Association for whatever they want, to run media training programs, educational programs, even to hire people, search for people, and importantly, to sponsor scientific symposiums at their APA's annual conference. Anyway, here's how big the influence is. In 1980, the annual revenues of the APA were something like around $10 million, and about half that came from member dues. Spring forward to 2007, and their annual revenues are around $70 million, but member dues haven't really gone up hardly at all. So you see a big reason for this increase is the dramatic increase in pharmaceutical money flowing to the APA. And as you well know, Peter, the APA leadership started talking about being in partnership with the pharmaceutical companies in the 1980s. You wrote about this in Toxic Psychiatry, if I remember correctly.
So let me take a little break there and tell a story about that.
Yep.
I wrote, now you'll know history better than me. The first President Bush went to Japan and got sick there. I think he actually vomited on the premier,
yep.
But he was ill. And it turned out that he had taken Halcyon, a sleeping pill, to – this is relevant to the partnership concept – the sleeping pill to adjust his sleep on the airplane. And the New York Times reported this, and they asked the question, why would a drug like Halcyon – be given to the President of the United States to adjust his sleep when it had just been banned in Great Britain for causing paranoia and memory loss, not the kinds of things you'd like your president to have. And so I wrote them a letter and sent them a picture, which they didn't use, of the president of Up, or the PR head, one of the big honchos at Upjohn, who makes Halcyon, shaking hands with the president of the American Psychiatric Association and giving him $1.5 million to use in any way he wanted.
Right.
And I said in the New York Times, short New York Times letter, that this to me indicated precisely why in the U.S. things don't get banned and they get given to the president when they might literally be found unusable in another country where the drug companies don't have quite that ability to give away $1.5 million. Well, the head of not the elected head, but the hired head of the APA, who was Mel Shabson at the time, Mel wrote in a letter saying, Dr. Bregan doesn't understand. We have an ethical partnership with the drug companies. And then at the same time, I got a letter sent to all psychiatrists that they also had a partnership with NAMI,
right,
which is the violent, vicious AstroTurf organization paid for by the drug company. So from thereafter, I said, no one can anymore accuse me of being a conspiracy theorist when I'm saying the drug companies are conspiring with the Psychiatric Association. They have a partnership.
Yeah, they, as you wrote, they even said this publicly, which is rather astonishing. But that's how they
They were so brazen, especially before I came along, Bob. They were so brazen, they thought they could say anything.
Yeah, and this would be presented to the people as a good thing. They would jointly work together to improve mental health.
But this is wonderful what you're saying, so go on with it. But I did want to bring in the partnership because it sort of brought up a fun moment for me.
Yeah, so what's going to happen here is now in institutional corruption speak, it means that the APA was captured by the pharmaceutical industry. And you will see, and we'll go forward to the corruption, they begin looking to pharmaceutical company to fund every darn thing you can imagine. But then the second thing was, and in some ways this is even, I think, more important, is in 1980, for the first time, the American Psychiatric Association allowed pharmaceutical companies to begin sponsoring, quote, scientific symposiums at its annual conference. And prior to that, you know, the pharmaceutical companies would have their exhibits, but they wouldn't allow to be able to put on these symposiums. But once they begin paying the APA to do so, and they, at one point, they're paying them $50,000 for the privilege of hosting this, and these become the breakfasts, the lunches, the dinners, which are held in the huge ballrooms. But what happens is the pharmaceutical companies don't have their employees present this information. What they start doing is paying academic psychiatrists from Harvard, Stanford, Johns Hopkins to giving these talks, which now are presented as if they're coming from, you know, these pristine leaders of knowledge, of fleshing out the latest findings in biology and telling us about how wonderful the drugs are. But they are seen as scientists. They're seen as thought leaders, these people with the prestige of these academic institutions. And what people don't really realize is that these talks are rehearsed, that sort of thing. But this opens up the door for pharmaceutical companies to basically, quote, capture academic psychiatry, because by the mid-1990s, virtually every academic psychiatrist is now working, has a relationship to one or more pharmaceutical companies. They're working as speakers, advisors, consultants, doing the research, that sort of thing, or at least putting their names on the research. And, of course, here's what happens. They say to themselves, look at me, I'm so smart, I'm a thought leader, that's why I'm getting paid. But, of course, the pharmaceutical companies understand the reason they're paying for this is because that money is going to get these individuals to tell a story that helps promote the selling of drugs. And I know in 1998, the New England Journal of Medicine was looking for someone who's an expert in depression to review the efficacy of antidepressants, and as they tried to find such a person, they basically couldn't, because anyone doing research on this at an academic institution was, in fact, had ties to pharmaceutical companies. And the reason this is so important for society is who do we look, you know, who do we as a society look to for reliable information about what is known about the biology, mental disorders, the efficacy of drugs? Well, it's these are the very people. It's the, quote, thought leaders, the professors of psychiatry at these academic institutions. We see them as scientists. We think they're going to be reliable in what they tell us. And what really happened here is they had been bought by the pharmaceutical companies, and that's going to, of course, corrupt the science that's done and the message, that storytelling that's done. So that influence, that economy of influence, I think, of with the pharmaceutical companies influencing psychiatry, that one's well known. But what I don't think we understand is an even more powerful one, and that's psychiatry's own, quote, guild influences. Because once psychiatry plants it, you know, publishes DSM-3, it's planting in the ground, so to speak, this new disease model. And it's sort of future. It's rehabilitation. Its sense of legitimacy is now based on selling this new disease model to the American public. Now, there has been no scientific advance to lead to this new conception. The new conception was based up really for, you know, for guild interest, for promoting guild interest, for promoting this sense of legitimacy. But they're not going to tell the public this. They're now going to start telling the public of advances in research that are going to validate, at least in the public mind, this new disease model. So what are they going to start telling us? They're going to start telling us, it looks like they're finding out the chemical imbalances are the cause of mental disorders. And then we're going to hear that these disorders are much more common than previously realized, and that they go under-recognized and under-treated. And then we're going to start hearing about these new great new drugs that balance those chemical imbalances, that fix those chemical imbalances, like insulin for diabetes. And by the way, that metaphor tells of an extraordinary advance. Think about it if it's true. It says that researchers, psychiatric researchers, have identified this single molecule that's amiss in the brain that causes depression, or that causes schizophrenia, or that causes ADHD. If this were true, this would be like the greatest discovery in the past 150 years, given how complex the human brain is. But that's what they told us. Now, this is a story, of course, that is going to validate the disease model, going to lift up the image of psychiatry in society, that sort of thing. And what you see is that once they publish DSM-3, the APA as an institution develops basically PR machinery to sell this story to the American public. So they set up a new PR office at the, you know, within their national offices. They begin running media training programs funded by the pharmaceutical companies in which they tell psychiatrists around the country, you know, what they're supposed to say. They run various educational campaigns that are, of course, funded by the drug companies. And by the way, this sort of PR, this selling of this model starts right away. They also have a media award day. So if you start parroting this stuff, you get a little award from the American Psychiatric Association as a good journalist. And they've been doing this PR work ever since. And basically it is, these are diseases of the brain. We're doing this great research. The drugs are very safe and effective. And the big problem is people aren't treated enough. These disorders go under-recognized and under-treated. And what I'm saying here with the psychiatry and influence is, once this medical profession, psychiatry, becomes devoted to telling the story of a disease model, it now, as a medical profession, is devoted to telling a PR story rather than a story of science. And now as it goes forward, if the science doesn't support it, what's it going to do? Is it going to tell us the science, or is it going to tell us this false PR story? So anyway, this is the tension that is set up. Starting with the publication and these economies of influence arise. Now let's go to the corruption. What you find is, relentlessly, psychiatry begins, the institution of psychiatry, in league with the pharmaceutical industry, starts telling us a false story, and they do so relentlessly. The chemical imbalance story was, in essence, a false story, And what I think is so astonishing, let's just take the low serotonin theory of depression. That was falling apart as a hypothesis in the early 80s. By 1990s, wherever they looked, they weren't finding that people with depression prior to going on medications had low serotonin. In 1999, their own textbook said, the hypothesis didn't, I'm talking about the American Psychiatric Association textbook said, you know what, this hypothesis wasn't really well-founded in the beginning, but we haven't found the evidence to be so. So they're acknowledging, in their own psychiatric textbook, it didn't pan out. And yet what happens? You can see 2001, the Richard Harding, the president of the American Psychiatric Association, saying, we now know, this is in a magazine article, that these disorders are disorders, diseases of the brain caused by chemical imbalances. The drugs fix those chemical imbalances. 2005, you have the American Psychiatric Association putting out a press release saying that, the educating of the American public has really gotten better because most now understand that mental disorders are real diseases of the brain due to chemical imbalances. And then the funny thing about the press release is they do complain a little bit that they don't, that the public doesn't yet understand that psychiatrists are experts in diagnosing and fixing chemical imbalances. And so they go to their GPs, their family doctors, unaware that these guys aren't experts in diagnosing chemical imbalances. I mean, it's just nonsense. You can still go on the APA website and read about how depression is due to low serotonin. So think about this. Medicine. The fundamental value of medicine is informed consent. You have to be honest with your patients. You can't tell them they have a biological problem that they don't have. Imagine going to a cardiologist and says, hey, you have a hole in your heart. I need to do a surgery on it, and you don't have that hole in your heart. Well, of course, that cardiologist would be sued and his license would be revoked. But talk to people diagnosed with depression or schizophrenia for the longest period of time, and virtually everyone would say, oh, I was told I have a chemical imbalance. This is why I need to take the drugs, and I need to take the drugs forever. Well, you can see that after DSM-3, this metaphor, this lie, in essence, moves into the heart of modern psychiatry, and it is an extraordinary corruption. It gets extended to kids. It's what enables, I think, in some ways, the pathologizing of kids, because parents and the media and society as a whole are led to believe these are chemical imbalances. And you can see, for example, leading ADHD people saying, well, wouldn't you treat your kid for diabetes? Shaming parents who don't want to put their kids on amphetamines. So this is an extraordinary betrayal. So this is the beginning of the corruption you see. By the way, by telling that story, they're validating the diagnoses in DSM-3. In other words, they're saying, look at our manuals, a valid diagnostic manual. Anyway, then going forward, the next thing is you can see, how about as they bring new drugs to market, such as Xanax as a treatment for panic disorder, or the new SSRIs, or the new atypicals, and you can find very quickly that the story of their efficacy is exaggerated. Stories of evidence of harm done is hidden. It's certainly not in the abstracts. You really have to dig through it. Or sometimes it's just out of sync with what's being said to the FDA. And Peter, you wrote about this with Xanax, alprazolam. When they do these studies, they do the study for testing it for panic disorder. And there was something called the Cross-National Panic Disorder Team. And I think this is important. Yes, it was Upjohn funded, but they actually did say to this team led by Gerald Clareman and others, you do the design, you do the analysis, and you report. And I think you'll remember, Peter, because you have written about this. When the patients were withdrawn from Xanax alprazolam, they got much, much worse, such that by the end of the study, the people randomized to drug were having more than three times as many panic attacks as the placebo group, and something like 44% exposed to alprazolam hadn't been able to get off, so you can see this path towards addiction happening. But were those poor results, were they in the abstract? Were they announced to the public? Were they, when the APA sent out its Dear Doctor letter, was this information presented to doctors around the country? No. And that's a betrayal. That's a betrayal of the values of science. And, of course, it's a betrayal of the public. And it was this study, I think, and really the arrival of Xanax that revitalizes the use of benzodiazepines. And here in Massachusetts last week, you know what we have? We have a bill that was being proposed by basically patients, people who've been on benzodiazepines and saying they've had their life ruined by this, and they were never informed of any of the addictive properties, all the problems that come with long-term use. So here we are, it's 2016, those studies were done in the 80s, and you have thousands of people who can attest to how it led to harm done, their lives basically going off the rails. Anyway, with the SSRIs, you can see a lot of the same sort of duplicity. With the atypical antipsychotics, basically the experts signed off on trials that were biased by design to make the new drugs look better than the old drugs. And so you see in the testing and the reporting of information this regular, constant corruption of a institution that's betraying its obligation to be to do honest research and to be honest storytellers about what that research has found. And so why aren't they? Why do they have to tell this false story? Well, it's because science wasn't supporting the story they wanted to tell. And we can go forward with the corruption, and it's not just, and one of the things I think is important, it's not just industry-funded studies where you see this corruption. The STAR-D trial, which is the largest study of antidepressants, or larger ever done, 4,041 patients, funded by the NIMH. And the message that was promoted to the public was that if you just keep trying antidepressants, you'll find one that will work, and eventually 67% were cured. In truth, only 38% after one of four times remitted, and it really wasn't full remission. But more importantly was this. At the end of 1 year, there were only 108 people out of the 4,041 who entered who had remitted and stayed well. In other words, 97% had either never remitted, relapsed, or dropped out. Now, that was the worst outcome I've ever seen from an antidepressant study or from a study of treatments for depression. And guess what? They didn't announce that result. They hid that result. It was sort of buried in a chart, but you couldn't figure out the chart. It took a psychologist named Ed Piggott to rely on Freedom of Information requests to finally put this together. But think about this. We hear about a cure rate of 67% when, in fact, at the end of 1 year, there were only 3% who were well. And that is just an example of this severe data spinning that occurred. And by the way, one of the things we do in psychiatry and influence is break down all the different ways they manipulated the data to try to come up with that 67%. And the most egregious is this. You were supposed to have, on the Hamilton scale, a baseline number of 14 or above, which is sort of moderate depression. But they actually entered people who weren't ill enough by this protocol even to, or depressed enough, I should say, to be eligible for the trial. But what the heck? They ended up reporting those results. And so many of the 108 who actually were well, in fact, weren't even depressed enough to enter the trial in the first place. And maybe the most, even that may not be the most egregious thing. You know the TADS study. The TADS study was done to resurrect antidepressants for kids. The investigators reported that they didn't see any extra suicide in the drug-treated patients, and this helped sort of counter the black box warning of antidepressants raising the risk of suicide in adolescents. In truth, 17 of 18 suicide attempts in that study were on kids exposed to fluoxetine, and that was completely hidden. Anyway, that's the second part. That's the corruption. It's profound. It's pervasive. It's at every turn. You can see that these economies of influence also do indeed affect the constructing of new boundaries in DSM-4 and DSM-5. They continue to expand those boundaries. then you can look at the clinical care guidelines, and drugs are always the first choice, the first line of treatment, and the people doing those clinical care guidelines, yeah, they come from prestigious medical schools, but they also have ties to the pharmaceutical companies. So what you see here is this, in a big picture way. You see an institution that was bought, captured by, you know, or corrupted by two economies of influence, pharma money and its own guild interests. And what we happened was that we as a society have subsequently organized our care, our understanding of mental disorders, even our sense of self around this false narrative. And of course, it's led to the pathologizing of childhood. It's led to a dramatically narrowing of what we think is normal. And I often like to think that the DSM-3 is ahistorical. And by that I mean is, if you read your Bible, you read religious tracts, you read Shakespeare, you read your novels, you can see that children, of course, struggle with their behavior, struggle with their minds, and of course it is completely normal to be anxious, depressed at times, and have the right things happen to you. You can become manic and psychotic, so you can see this vision of humankind struggling with its mind, its emotions, is sort of a central thing we do. And what do we get with DSM-3? This idea you're supposed to be sort of happy all the time, kids are supposed to be well-behaved, and if you fall outside those norms, now you can be diagnosed and treated with drugs. And where are we today? Something like 20% of Americans take a psychiatric drug on a daily basis, and by the age 18, something close to that of our kids are diagnosed as well. So what's the social injury? Well, the pathologizing of children, the fact that once children get diagnosed and medicated, so many of them end up with a life as a mental patient laid out before them. We have a soaring burden of mental illness in our society. The number of people on disability is now up to about 5 million people. That's fourfold higher than it was in 1987. So increasing burden of mental illness, that's part of it. The pathologizing of childhood, the fact that all of mental health has been practiced in the absence of informed consent, and finally this impoverished philosophy of being where, you know, children are supposed to be so well-behaved, etc. So the reshaping of our society has been profound, thorough, and it's all been done because of this promotion of this false narrative. So what do we do now? Well, the idea in institutional corruption is you have to neutralize those economies of influence, which means in this case you'd have to neutralize the pharma money. You'd have to stop that flow of money to individual psychiatrists and to the APA. But then you'd also need to neutralize that guild influence. And that's what's so tough, because psychiatry, this is the image it's presented to society for 35 years, and it's pretty hard now to say, whoops, sorry, it was all a false narrative. So my own feeling, and Lisa Cosgrove's as well, is we have to, as a society, somehow strip psychiatry of its power. It just can't be the medical specialty that has domain over this authority, over this part of our social lives. So that's psychiatry and influence, Peter, sort of summarized in 45 minutes.
Well, that's just an amazing presentation, Bob. We're listening to Robert Whittaker, and his new book is Psychiatry Under the Influence, and it's with Lisa Cosgrove, who's done independently good work, too. There's so many directions to go in with this. One of the things that has become more and more apparent to me is the depth of the way it's corrupted our cultural thinking. It's as if, you captured it with the term ahistoric. It's as if all the wisdom of the Western world about the struggle to live, all the wisdom about how hard it is to be a human being and how we have to develop ethics and spiritual viewpoints and use the Ten Commandments and so on, all the wisdom going back as far as we have written materials and even traditions is chucked into the toilet, and instead we have biochemical imbalances which don't even exist, replacing it as a theory of human suffering. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah,
and I think it's profoundly affecting our young people. They really don't have the sense of heroism that it takes to live life, the sense of honor, the sense of principle, the sense of a religious dedication or a philosophic dedication. A lot of our young people just don't have it. And a lot of the reason for that is they have a very simple-minded materialism that they basically need a drug. It's really dreadful.
Yeah, Peter, I think you've really put your finger on this. This is the big, from a societal point of view, this is exactly what has happened. And the loss is almost incomprehensible. It's so profound. Because think about how societies have governed themselves. They've had a philosophy of being and what it means to be human. And even this sense of, yes, we struggle with our minds, but suffering is part of being alive. And, you know, whether you think of your existential philosophy was that, you know, if you don't suffer, you're not likely to be as, you know, as a thoughtful and as an empathic a person as you might otherwise be. But there's this other part of it, of course, is part of the heroism, part of the resilience is, yes, we're flawed creatures. We do struggle with our minds, but part of it is asserting our will to organize ourselves, to govern our behavior in spite of such difficulties. And now we have this reductionist view where suffering is pathologized. Childhood isn't about growing up and organizing your behavior in a certain way, but it's just that somehow at age 5 you're supposed to be able to sit in a classroom and do whatever they tell you to do right away. The loss is just extraordinary. I sometimes am asked to speak at universities today, you know, undergraduate universities, and you hear a dialogue that goes like this: I have ADHD. I am bipolar. This is how they've learned to see themselves. And something like more than, at many schools today, more than 50% of the students will access mental health services. And think about that during their time at the school. That's because they've been taught that they're sort of robots or governed by this brain chemistry, and they're not taught about how to be resilient. So really what DSM-3 did, it gave us a new philosophy of being, which, you know, benefited commercial interests, but is completely ahistorical, and it leads, you know, in my opinion, and I think it sounds like yours, to an impoverished inner sense of self, an impoverished philosophy of being, and an impoverished society for thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be human, and how should we organize our society? And you can, you know, you can think about it with foster care kids, but also how you should build your schools, that sort of thing, what you should teach. It's just devastating when you think about it.
Another thing it does, Bob, it makes us atomistic in our thinking. The entire model is about defects in an individual.
Right.
And through 2 million years of evolution, we have never been isolated individuals. The nearest thing to being isolated individuals occurs only 10,000 years ago, and probably more like 1,000 years ago, with civilization, where people can live alone in apartments and so on. But we're a social creature. We don't develop anxiety, guilt, shame out of our own personal isolated experience. We develop it in a family context, a school context, a church context, a patriotic country concept context. So it just robs us of everything, our inner moral compass and our sense that we're made of each other. We must relate to each other. We must love one another. All of the basic lessons of life are being trampled by the pharmaceutical industry in cahoots with psychiatry. It is a disaster.
Yeah, you know, really, by evolution senses, I don't even really think we can. I mean, we're tribal creatures. Obviously, we were raised in tribes, and our whole being is supposed to be so social. You look at the baby that's born, and the first thing they're doing is learning to read faces, and of course, language. I don't even think. Yeah, we can live in apartments alone, but you can't really. It's really hard to live an isolated life where you don't really have good social contact. I mean, I almost think you can't think in isolation. You can only think in response to others. You can only organize your behavior in response to others.
Yes, we're nurtured by others and brought to life by others. And wow, this is so important. We've got about a minute and a half left. Do you want to make a closing remark? Robert Whittaker, do you want to make a closing remark for about a minute until the music starts?
Yeah, I think this is as profound a challenge that is confronting our society today as any. In fact, I think it is the challenge of the day, is to reject this impoverished philosophy of being and create a new one. And I honestly think our future societal health is dependent on getting rid of this one and creating a new philosophy of being. In other words, we need to get rid of this disease model and this pernicious influence in our society.
Bob, thank you so much. And I've tried to address these issues, by the way, in my new book, which is Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, because I place guilt, shame, and anxiety and emotional numbing and anger into the context of how we learn to live with each other and how we evolved. And we've got to get back to this. We've got to get back to people thinking, theorizing, understanding human nature in the context of evolution and our societies and our social relationships. And psychiatry's made a mockery of all that kind of knowledge. Thank you so much for being on the show again, Bob. It's Robert Whittaker and Lisa Cosgrove and Adam, Psychiatry Under the Influence. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Peter. Really appreciate it.